Spotlight from Miko Itawa and entire team. It's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories: Israel targeting an area near the Syrian capital with missiles. The details coming up next. Sebastian Piñera surviving an impeachment bid. Chile's Senate votes against removing the president over corruption allegations. And a warning from the U.S. Treasury. The federal government could soon run out of money as political wrangling over the debt limit heats up. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Israel has launched two missiles targeting an empty building in the south of the Syrian capital, Damascus. We were joined by our man in Damascus, Muhammad Ali, who gave us the latest on the attack.
The Syrian state news media reported that at about 12:45 a.m. local time here in Damascus, Israel carried out an attack firing two missiles targeting south of Damascus, an area south of Damascus. The state news media outlets did not confirm if those missiles were surface-to-surface missiles or if they were fired from an Israeli fighter jets. However, the direction of the enemy missiles were from the occupied Syrian Golan over there. Of course, according to the media reports, official media reports here, the two missiles, one of the two missiles hit an empty building south of Damascus, while the other was intercepted by Syrian air defenses. Still, there is no official statement that came out from an official military source here or from the foreign ministry yet. Usually a statement comes out from an official source. We have to wait and see what will come out, if any more details would be disclosed. However, it's definitely not the first time. Almost every week or two, Israel carries out an attack targeting Syrian army positions, whether around the capital Damascus in Syria's south or even in Homs countryside and in the Syria's northeast. Definitely not a surprise for the Syrian army. Israel's an enemy. Usually, the foreign ministry sends letters to the United Nations calling on the international body to shoulder responsibility in forcing Israel to respect sovereign countries and the independence of countries.
The Israeli High Court has rejected for the fourth time in a row an appeal for the immediate release of Palestinian administrative detainee Qaid Fosfos. He's facing the risk of sudden death after 125 days of hunger strike. Qaid al-Fosfos and four other prisoners are on an open-ended hunger strike to protest their detention. Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
For the fourth time, the Israeli High Court has rejected an appeal made to release Qaid al-Fosfos, a Palestinian prisoner whom his health condition is seriously deteriorating due to his open-ended hunger strike that he started 125 days ago. Al-Fosfos is protesting his imprisonment under Israel's administrative detention without charge or trial. The Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, who made the appeal, says Al-Fosfos could be minutes away from sudden death, especially after doctors at the Barzilai Medical Center, where he's being hospitalized, said diagnosis showed he developed blood clots.
It's obvious that Israeli authorities want to adopt a new approach in dealing with the hunger strikes against administrative detention. They are exerting force at the utmost. Even if Al-Fosfos or other hunger striking prisoners die, they don't care. Maybe they think this way they will be unfolding this file. We are continuing our efforts and we really hope Al-Fosfos won't die because the repercussions will be out of control inside the jails and outside it.
In addition to Qaid al-Fosfos, four other prisoners have been refusing to eat, also to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. They are all demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. Weekly protests continue to take place in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners. Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah.
Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoners follows the same path in the future.
The Israeli occupation does not know the meaning of humanity. Literally, those prisoners are dying. They must immediately be released. Their detention is illegal in the first place.
Over the years, Israel has placed thousands of Palestinians in administrative detention for prolonged periods of time without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports, which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds over 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, with some 500 of them under the illegal administrative detention. Prisoners advocacy groups say the only request of Qaid al-Fosfos and other Palestinian hunger-striking prisoners is their freedom and an end to their arbitrary administrative detention. After 125 days of an open-ended hunger strike against Israel's illegal policy, al-Fosfos' family says he would be victorious either through his long-awaited release or martyrdom. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Iran's ambassador to the UN slams the disproportionate representation and power of Western nations in the Security Council.
Currently, the West has a strong presence and influence in the Council. Three of its members have veto power, while the main regions are fully represented in terms of both the number as well as privileges, including veto power. This means inequality among the regions. Likewise, there are many states within a given region that have never found a chance to become a council member, while there are states in the same region that each have served between 10 to 22 years in the council. This means inequality within a region.
Addressing a plenary session of the General Assembly, Majid Taht Ravanchi said the Security Council is facing a credibility crisis. Amid increasing deficiencies, he said the Council must be reformed to ensure equitable rather than geographical representation. Iranian diplomat also censured the use of sanctions as a collective punishment of entire nations without furthering peace and security. He described the restrictions as blunt and blind instruments that have raised fundamental ethical questions. Earlier on Tuesday, Taht Ravanchi said, the Security Council must only exercise its power to impose sanctions as a last resort, if at all necessary.
Chapter 7 functions, including sanctions, must be applied only as a measure of last resort, if necessary, and after all means of peaceful settlement of disputes have been exhausted. In discharging its functions, the Council must accord priority to prevention and resorting to non-coercive measures under Charter's Chapter 6.
The Iranian envoy criticized the council's, quote, frequent, hasty, and excessive invocation of coercive measures set out in Chapter 7. He said the practice has complicated the situation and resulted in violations of sovereignty and territorial integrity of states and abuses of human rights. Takhtarabanchi said the council must instead give priority to prevention and resorting to non-coercive measures under Chapter 6 of the UN Charter. Political scientist Mr. Wilmer Leon believes that the United States has used the UN Security Council to act like a hegemon, but more and more countries are starting to oppose this.
Look at the number of UN resolutions that have condemned the Zionist state of Israel as it deals with the Palestinians, and how those resolutions just get totally ignored primarily because the United States stands in the way of having those resolutions enforced. It's also important to look at the sanction regime that the United States employs at a whim. So, you know, one has to ask oneself, when Nicaragua engages in peaceful, honest elections and the United States imposes sanctions on Nicaragua, how is a peaceful election in Nicaragua a threat to peace? The United States has decided that because it is a global imperial hegemon and it is still operating in the mindset of a unipolar world, that it can impose its will on anyone at any time for any reason. And now Iran and China and Russia and Nicaragua and Venezuela, they're all saying, not anymore.
In Chile, an impeachment process against President Sebastián Piñera is now over, with the Senate declining to remove him despite a lower house vote last week over corruption allegations. Senators needed at least 29 votes in favor of impeachment, but they only got 24. The lower house of Congress approved the impeachment trial last week. Piñera is accused of using his presidency for business gains following the Pandora Papers leak recently. Documents reveal the offshore transactions of major political figures. According to those papers, Piñera has sold a mining company using a tax haven. He denies the allegation. This was the second attempt to remove the president. The first one failed in 2019 over a crackdown on anti-government protesters. The drama of Piñera comes just days before Chileans will head to the polls to choose his successor. To another one of our headline stories, the U.S. Treasury Secretary says the government could be running out of money by mid-September. In a letter, the lawmakers Janet Yellen encouraged Congress to raise or suspend the United States debt ceiling as soon as possible in order to avoid a default. This comes as President Biden is seeking congressional approval for his climate and education spending plan, which amounts to $1.8 trillion. Republicans are opposed to the so-called Build Back Better plan. Back in October, the party also resisted raising the government's debt limit, almost causing the U.S. to default on its loans for the first time in history. Economists warn such an outcome would cause a catastrophic financial crisis. Let's bring in our man, Dr. Colin Campbell from Washington, D.C., to talk to us about this, where time is about 10, 12 minutes past 1 a.m. Dr. Campbell, many, many thanks for staying up and talking to us at this time. Please explicate the situation.
Well, because of the fact that the U.S. runs such deficit spending, and because of the money that they actually allocate to various operations, whether that's through military or just daily benefits that people get, we run a high budget. Now, there has to be funds that are allocated for this budget. If we overrun that budget, then we hit what's called the debt ceiling. And what the Treasury Secretary is saying, that if that debt ceiling hits earlier than expected, then of course we will run out of money. But what's important here is that Janet Yellen predicted one day that the U.S. would run out of money, but now that projection is 2 weeks out. That prediction is 2 weeks later now. 2 weeks later now, because of the signing of the infrastructure bill that President Biden signed this week. So, for example, money that would go to highways and roads and fixing up some of the infrastructure for roadways in our country. Because the president signed that bill into law, that money will now be transferred to that department, and it will not go bankrupt, so to speak, in order to build more roads and improve the roads that we have. That's one aspect of the reason why the nation is not expected to go bankrupt unless a bill or a law is passed until December 15th now. Her original projection was at the beginning of next month. Now what that also does is it gives Congress an extra almost 2 weeks to try to balance the budget, try to figure out a way and how to raise the debt ceiling so the U.S. has enough money to pay its debts. Obviously, if the U.S. hits the debt ceiling without any type of amelioration, any kind of fix, this is bad for the credit rating for the U.S. This could put people on furlough. This is definitely not the predicament that the Biden administration would want to be in heading into 2022. One reason is the holidays. You don't want more people with economic woes and professional woes heading through the holiday season. Not only that, it's cold, so you have weather. You don't want people to be homeless. But then think about politically. 2022 is midterm elections. The Biden administration is already facing a very low approval rating, vice president even lower. Congress has all been consistently low, and it's run by Democrats right now. If these approval ratings continually head into 2022 and a few months into 2022 with low approval ratings, it's not good news for Democrats. And so this could put the Biden administration in political peril if that debt ceiling isn't raised.
Many, many thanks. That's Dr. Colin Campbell, our man in Washington, D.C. That comprehensive explanation on the situation in the U.S. Many, many thanks, Colin, and take good care of yourself. Have a much better rest of the night. Their final destination is the United States, but for now, this migrant caravan consisting of more than 1,500 people is stopping in a Mexican state. Based on some estimates, the number is much higher. Veracruz is the third state the caravan is crossing on its way to the northern border with the United States. Mexican authorities say foreign national migration cards are issued for the caravan members to ensure they can work in Mexico as long as their activities are legal. The caravan with a large number of women and children set off from the country south last month. Washington's been pressuring Mexico to contain them. Mexico says it's not blocking their progress, but is asking the migrants to use their documentation to stay in Mexico. In other news, the United States says it'll look for ways to prevent Nicaragua from obtaining funds from international financial institutions. The U.S. State Department's top Latin American official announced the decision after a Nicaraguan election that Washington has announced as a sham. Brian Nichols said he'll work with the Treasury Department to try to prevent President Daniel Ortega's government from getting further access to international lending. Washington has imposed an entry ban on Ortega, his vice president wife, and members of his cabinet following the November the 7th election. Last week, incumbent Ortega won the presidential election, clinching his fourth consecutive term in office. The Daesh terrorist group claims responsibility for coordinated suicide bombings that rocked the Ugandan capital of Kampala. The three attackers are said to have been Ugandan. Six people lost their lives in the blasts, including the bombers. Two police officers are among the victims. Several dozen were also injured, five of them critically. The explosions, which took place minutes apart close to the Ugandan parliament building, sent the lawmakers running for cover. The incident comes less than a month after a similar bomb attack claimed by Daesh killed one and injured three others in Kampala. Many thanks for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
and a supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Its ambition was clear. The United Nations Climate Summit in Glasgow, Scotland, was meant to secure a deal to give the world a chance to avert the worst impacts of climate change by capping global warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels. The article you're about to hear has been written by Reuters news agency journalist Kate Abnett, Valerie Volkovici, Richard Waldmanis, and Barbara Lewis. The piece is titled, Was Glasgow Pact a Win for Climate? Time will tell. Its ambition was clear. The United Nations Climate Summit in Glasgow, Scotland, was meant to secure a deal to give the world a chance to avert the worst impacts of climate change by capping global warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius, that is 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels. The accord met that bar, but just barely, and its ultimate success will be determined by the future actions of the governments that thrashed it out, according to the summit's UK hosts, participants and observers. I think today we can say with credibility that we've kept the 1.5 degrees Celsius within reach, but its pulse is weak and we will only survive if we keep our promises, the summit's president, Alok Sharma, said late on Saturday after the pact was adopted. The deal, backed by nearly 200 countries, for the first time explicitly targeted fossil fuels, the biggest driver of man-made global warming, asked governments to accelerate emissions cuts, and promised more money for poor countries struggling with climate change. It also ushered in voluntary pledges and pacts from countries, companies and investors to clean up emissions from cars and from planes, curb the powerful greenhouse gas methane, protect forests, and bolster green finance. But the agreement was packed with compromises, leaving all sides, from wealthy nations seeking faster action to resource-rich developing countries and low-lying island states, dissatisfied. The approved texts are a compromise, said United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres. They reflect the interests, the conditions, the contradictions, and the state of political will in the world today. That leaves the world highly vulnerable. We are still knocking on the door of climate catastrophe. It is time to go into emergency mode, Antonio Guterres said. The summit did not deliver enough emissions-cutting pledges from countries to set a clear path to limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Instead, it struck a deal for the nearly 200 countries represented at the event to increase their pledges next year to close the gap. But the gap is huge. Governments' current pledges to cut emissions this decade would lead to a 2.4 degrees Celsius rise in temperature, in global warming terms. To align with the 1.5 degrees Celsius rise, that's the target, countries need to cut carbon dioxide emissions by 45% by 2030 from 2010 levels. Under current pledges, emissions would rise by nearly 14% by 2030. While compromises at COP26 keep the 1.5 degrees Celsius rise target within reach, it is hanging by a thread, said Bert Wonder, the acting chief executive officer of environmental group Avaaz. China, the world's biggest carbon dioxide emitter, announced in a joint declaration with the United States last week that it would accelerate efforts to reduce emissions by curbing coal use, tackling methane, and preserving forests. It provided few details, however. China was also among a group of resource-rich developing countries that watered down language targeting fossil fuels in the text of the Glasgow deal. The draft called on countries to phase out coal use and fossil fuel subsidies. But as the negotiations played out in Glasgow, words were changed. Coal became unabated coal, leaving scope for continued use of coal that uses emissions capturing technology. Subsidies became inefficient subsidies, without a definition of which types of subsidies counted as inefficient, providing wriggle room for governments to continue funding oil, gas and coal. A last-minute intervention by India and China just before the pact was adopted in Glasgow also changed the requested coal phase out to a phase down. The Glasgow Agreement delivered a mixed bag on finance, a contentious issue between poor countries and their richer and powerful counterparts. Finance boils down to the issue of fairness and whether rich countries, whose historical emissions are largely responsible for causing climate change, will pay the costs of its imposing on the world's poorest countries. The deal made some headway. It asked developed countries to at least double their collective provision of climate finance for adaptation to developing countries' parties from 2019 levels by 2025. It also, for the first time, made mention of loss and damage in the cover section of the agreement. Loss and damage refers to the costs countries are already facing from climate-driven disasters, for which those countries have for years sought compensation. But after resistance from the United States of America, the European Union, and other rich industrialized countries, the accord failed to secure funds for that compensation. The world's most vulnerable countries backed the final deal grudgingly in Glasgow. The negotiator from Antigua and Barbuda, Leah Nicholson, said her country and other small island states at the talks in Glasgow will express our grievances in due course. Rich industrialized countries broke a 2009 promise to deliver $100 billion annually by 2020 in climate finance, making poor countries wary that promised cash will not arrive. They now expect to deliver the $100 billion by 2023.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On Thursday, January 29, 2004, a plane carrying Lebanese prisoners landed at Beirut's airport. 4 years of indirect negotiations between Israel and Hezbollah had reached a conclusion.
الشمس كواكب حيلك يا هم بالطيب عرسا.
The prisoner exchange had taken place, and Hezbollah had been able to free more than 400 Arab and Lebanese detainees from Israeli prisons. This was a great victory for Hezbollah. All regional media outlets were covering every single moment of the celebration. But at the event, there was an empty chair. The chair belonged to the only Lebanese prisoner who had not been released. The only Lebanese prisoner who the Israelis had explicitly refused to release. Regretting it in the future only meant one thing: taking Israeli prisoners again. It was a difficult and complex operation which the Secretary General had announced to his jihadi forces in front of the cameras of different news outlets and not in secret. The operation would be directly planned and executed by his jihadi deputy, a man who very few people knew, a secret named Haj Radwan. He was born in 1962 in Beirut's Shia neighborhood. His father owned a small restaurant, and his mother, who was a pious woman, would hold religious studies classes for the ladies in the neighborhood. He was the first child of their small family. He grew up and went to school in the same neighborhood. He was 13 years old when their normal life was suddenly turned upside down. In 1975, a civil war broke out between left and right-wing parties. The war tore Beirut apart in two sections. Many of the people who lived in the neighborhoods where the war was being fought left their homes and took refuge in the villages. He, along with his family, was forced to move to his father's ancestral village in the south. This unwanted migration made him more familiar with Palestinian groups. He underwent initial military trainings in Palestinian camps and became an official member of the Fatah organization. Upon his return to Beirut, because of his intelligence and courage, he made great progress in Fatah and became a member of the Elite Forces 17, an intelligence force at the heart of the Fatah organization, which was responsible for the personal security of the leaders of the organization and combating Mossad's activities. He became familiar with Imam Khomeini with the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. He, like many other Muslim youths, slowly became captivated by a Marja who had defeated the Shah of Iran with empty hands. His concern was the liberation of Palestine and had made Islam the basis of his government. On June the 6th, 1982, when Ariel Sharon gave the orders to attack Lebanon, he had traveled to Iran as the bodyguard of Sayyid Mohammad Hossein Fazlullah. They had come to Tehran to take part in the conferences of liberation movements, but he also had a personal motivation: meeting Imam Khomeini. It was a dream that many Lebanese Muslim youths had in those days, but word of the Israeli attack on Lebanon cut the conferences short, and the participants quickly returned to Lebanon. He also went back to Lebanon after meeting with Imam Khomeini. When they arrived, the east of Beirut had been occupied and some neighborhoods were besieged by the Israeli forces. In their first attack, he and a group of his friends were able to destroy an Israeli tank and personnel carrier. Word of this attack caused the Lebanese army to open up a case against him, accusing him of fighting Israel. The case was filed under his real name, Imad Fayez Mughniyan. After the occupation, Lebanon had become another country. Palestinian fighters had been expelled. A pro-Israeli government was in place, and the massacres of Sabra and Shatila had wiped away the courage of the people to resist. The days of absolute hopelessness and fear had begun. But in the fall of that year, an important event took place in the south. It was a rainy morning when a white Peugeot 504 sped its way into the Israeli military headquarters in the city of Tyre. There was a huge explosion, and a few seconds later, the building housing the Israeli forces came crashing down on them. In one day, in one attack, more than 100 Israeli officers and soldiers were killed. The attack became the biggest anti-Israeli operation in the history of the resistance. It was after this attack which Imad, as one of the main planners, began living in hiding. The 1980s were a difficult time for Western forces in Lebanon, and the name Imad Mournia was word of mouth as the cause of these difficult days. Even though during these days he had his own independent group and organization, he used all his power to establish, shape, and strengthen Hezbollah. And his preference was to fight Israel with his own group, his own way, and with a free hand. Intelligence services from different countries were after his arrest or assassination. A ghost who would easily pass the borders of different countries, but they were never able to pinpoint his location. He had dedicated his life to the struggle with Israel. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah became Secretary General, Imad became the leader of Hezbollah's intelligence apparatus and used all his experience for Hezbollah to have the upper hand when it came to the information warfare with Israel. This upper hand proved itself with the successful assassinations of Israeli commanders and the leaders of the Lahad Army. But the more significant event happened in 1997, when he was able to decode the imagery of Israeli drones, and with that he was able to cause the defeat of the Israeli Special Forces unit in Ansariya village. The Ansariya operation was the first time in Israeli history that its Special Forces unit had been defeated. A year after the Ansariya operation, Haj Imad became Sayed Nasrallah's jihadi deputy and chose the name Haj Radwan for himself. While maintaining his previous role in the intelligence apparatus, he also took over command of Hezbollah's military. It didn't take long before operations against Israel became more extensive and goal-oriented. He used the years of experience he had in the intelligence fight against Israel in military operations. He was a commander who would count on all financial and material facilities, but would never solely rely on them. Years later, Israel withdrew from Lebanese soil. This was the first time that Israel was forced to leave the areas it had occupied because of resistance operations. And again, Haj Radwan's name was registered as a leading role in Israel's historic withdrawal. The story didn't end there. There were still many Lebanese prisoners in Israeli jails, something Hezbollah could not ignore. Even though taking Israeli hostages was difficult and impossible, it seemed to be the only way to get the prisoners released. Haj Radwan was the commander of this impossible mission in the Sheba Farms. It was after this operation that negotiations to exchange prisoners sped up. 4 years of indirect negotiations between Hezbollah and Israel came to fruition on Thursday, January 29, 2004. 439 prisoners and 59 martyrs were exchanged with a Mossad officer and the bodies of three Israeli soldiers. This left only one Lebanese prisoner in Israeli custody. This was why Hezbollah's Secretary General promised more hostage takings in the ceremony to welcome the prisoners. It was obvious that he was counting on the capability and power of a commander who had spent his entire life fighting Israel. Haj Radwan had to carry out the operation at a time when the enemy had put its forces on total standby. He chose an elite group of Hezbollah's best forces and held difficult and clear-cut training sessions for them. He was present for the trainings because he wanted to personally make sure that the operation would succeed. On the morning of July the 12th, 2006, Hezbollah forces were able to pass through the border barriers and take two Israeli soldiers hostage. Unprecedented event, the Israeli Prime Minister ordered attacks on Lebanon. Israeli fighter jets bombed Lebanese cities and villages from the south to the north. Then, by relying on their spies, they targeted Hezbollah's missile launch pads, not knowing that they had once again been tricked and fallen in the trap of Haj Radwan. In the previous years, he had allowed Israel to identify centers where Hezbollah had its missiles so that Israeli intelligence capabilities would focus on these unreal targets. The general staff of the Israeli military directly informed the prime minister of the destruction of these targets and congratulated him on winning the war. But exactly the next day, more than 100 missiles were launched at Israeli settlements. After that, and for weeks, the Israeli Air Force was bombing Lebanon indiscriminately, only with the hope of destroying Hezbollah's launch pads. And on the other side, Hezbollah missiles were targeting occupied Palestine, including Haifa. This caused the commander of the Israeli forces to decide to launch a ground attack on Lebanon by counting on their Merkava tanks. But Haj Radwan and the other resistance commanders had already predicted the attack. Hezbollah fighters used Hornet missiles and roadside bombs to block the path of the Israeli attack. In the end, after 33 days, the Israelis gave in to a ceasefire without being able to get their hostages back or destroying Hezbollah's launch pads. And this was how the longest war Israel had fought ended in its defeat. 2 years after the 33-day war, the Israelis were forced to release Samir Qantar and other prisoners that Hezbollah wanted. Haj Radwan was not present on that day, but he had planned the hostage-taking operation in such a way that the Israelis were not able to know whether their hostages were dead or alive even after he was gone. On July the 16th, 2008, the prisoner exchange deal was implemented, an operation which was adorned by the name of martyr Haj Radwan, a man whose name is registered in history alongside Israel's greatest defeats.
Limelight. Satellite analysis: over the past 20 years by the U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration's Ames Research Laboratory proves that China has contributed more to greening the planet than any other country in the world. We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by KJ Ngo and Michael Wong. The piece is titled China Offers Solutions to Climate Change. Greenhouse gas concentrations are driving catastrophic climate change and creating an existential threat to the planet. But there is a way out. Last year, Chinese President Xi Jinping pledged that China's carbon dioxide emissions would peak before 2030 and that the country would become carbon neutral by 2060. China has a history of setting ambitious, nearly impossible goals and then achieving them, often before deadline, so this pledge is significant. Under the Communist Party of China, Beijing has already created an economic miracle in transforming China into the largest economy in the world. It ended extreme poverty while creating the largest middle class in the world. It has virtually eradicated COVID-19 through non-pharmaceutical methods, while vaccinating up to 20 million people daily and pledging the largest number of vaccines, 2.2 billion, and distributing more than a billion to the rest of the world. It has also been applying similar focus and national resolve to tackle climate change. China has the greatest program of adopting renewable energy of any country. It generates more renewable power than North, Central, and South America, 42 countries combined. It has more solar parks and wind farms than any other country in the world. Last year, it established more wind power than the rest of the world combined. It has more electric vehicles than any other country. It operates 420,000 electric buses, 99% of the world's total. The city of Shenzhen alone has 16,000 e-buses and 22,000 e-taxis. It aims to have 325 million electric vehicles operating by 2050. Its high-speed rail network, spanning 38,000 kilometers, is so extensive and effective that air travel is starting to become obsolete. No country has a dense, large, and efficient system of clean public transportation and high-speed rail network as China. In addition, China has the greatest carbon sequestration afforestation program in the world, creating forests the size of Belgium every year. It has doubled its forest coverage to 23% over the past 40 years. Satellite analysis over the past 20 years by the U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA's Ames Research Laboratory, proves that China has contributed more to greening of the planet than any other country. In other words, by almost every sustainability index, China is a world leader, far ahead of the United States, for example, and is pioneering a way forward for the planet. It will likely hit its targets ahead of time. These things are happening because the Communist Party of China, the CPC, has written sustainability and ecological development directly into its constitution. This is then implemented into regional and local policy, such as sustainable eco-city mandates, transportation policy, energy infrastructure, and advanced research, as well as dedicated funding for alternative energy development for companies to start up and build clean energy technology. These commitments exist despite the fact that China's historical and per capita greenhouse gas emissions and CO2 emissions are a fraction of the world's total. According to the World Bank, on an annual per capita basis, China's share is less than half of the United States. Its household energy consumption is 1/8 of that of the United States. Cumulative historical amounts matter because carbon dioxide does not dissipate but accrues in the atmosphere. Stocks, not flows, are what matter. In accounting, you look at one's total accrued debt, not one's daily credit expenditures, to determine what he or she owes to others. Likewise, you have to look at historically accrued greenhouse gas emissions to understand harms, liabilities, and mitigation responsibilities accurately. Note also between 14% and 33% of China's annual greenhouse gas emissions are actually the West that have been offshored through manufacturing. This way, the West gets to have its cake and also to eat it. Consume, pollute, and destroy the planet while virtue signaling and blaming developing countries like China for the cost of Western consumption. Much too has been made of China's coal plants, but the fact is that they are advanced, supercritical or ultra-supercritical plants, which means they are much more efficient and cleaner than many of the industrial-era legacy plants of the United States. China has a more sustainable approach along the entire chain of production and consumption. That said, China understands coal as a transitional source of energy that it wants to phase out, except that the United States has an explicit military plan to choke off China's alternative fuel imports through the South China Sea. China needs to maintain backup capacity in clean coal as it leapfrogs into renewable energy, which will constitute fully 80% of its energy portfolio by 2060. As for funding overseas coal plants, 87% of that finance comes from the West or from Japan, and China has committed not to fund any more foreign coal plants. With these commitments, China has demonstrated that it is dedicated and committed to both national and global sustainability and carbon neutrality. Last, most calculations of greenhouse gas emissions leave out the U.S. military footprint, the single largest institutional emitter in the world, greater than the combined emissions of 140 nations. Add the cost of endless U.S. wars and subtract offshore greenhouse gas emissions from the West from China's total, you get a very different picture of responsibility for global emissions. Despite the hypercritical finger-pointing at China at COP26 summit in Glasgow by the worst polluters, the United States and the West, the simple facts refute the lies. China is a net greenhouse gas creditor nation, not a debtor. The Lancet showed that 92% of emissions above the safe level of 350 parts per million can be attributed to Global North, of which 40% of these emissions are the United States' alone. By contrast, China is a net creditor nation. In other words, the atmosphere, atmospheric carrying capacity, a precious global commons, has been colonized and monopolized by the West to the detriment of the rest of the world. In this respect, the United States bears the greatest individual responsibility for the global climate crisis. Despite all of this, China leads in solutions, in technology, in policy, in transition planning, and in implementation. It is not only pulling its weight, it is showing the world a way forward. This is in